through models of supernova process, but also predicting nearby supernova to occur in mid-March 2191. Research done in collaboration with SMU doctoral student Elaine Bernstein of New York. Strong suggestion from graduate associates of Ms. Bernstein that she was actually one with the new insights. Brown catapulted to fame as a result of his bold and correct prediction. June 2190, Brown divorced wife, from whom he had been separated for 18 months. Separation had started 3 months after Elaine Bernstein had begun graduate work. December 2190, married Ms. Bernstein in Dallas. March 2191, supernova 2191A filled night sky with light, as predicted by Brown et al. June 2191. Brown signed 2-year science reporting contract with CBS. Jumped to UBC in 2194, and then, at recommendation of agent, to INN in 2197. December 2193. Brown awarded top ISA medal for distinguished scientific achievement. November 2199. Signed exclusive multi-million mark multi-year contract with Schmidt and Hagenest to exploit all possible commercial applications of Newton mission, including books, videos, and educational material. Teamed with Francesca Sabatini as other principal, cosmonauts Heilmann and Tabori as consultants. Signing bonus of 2 million marks deposited in secret account in Italy. Her alarm awakened her after she had been asleep for only 2 hours. Nicole dragged herself out of bed and freshened up in the retractable wash basin. She moved slowly into the corridor and turned toward the lobby. The other 4 space cadets were gathered around David Brown in the control center, excitedly reviewing the details of the initial sortie.
All right, Richard Wakefield was saying. First priorities are the lightweight individual chairlifts by the right and left stairways and 1 heavy load elevator from the hub to the central plane. Then we set up a temporary control center at the edge of the plane and assemble and test the 3 rovers. Crewed campsite tonight, base camp at the beta site near the edge of the cylindrical sea tomorrow. We will leave the assembly and deployment of the 2 helicopters for tomorrow, the icemobiles and motorboats for day 3.
That's an excellent summary, Dr. Brown replied. Francesca will go with the 4 of you while you're setting up the infrastructure this morning. When the lightweight lifts are installed and operational, Admiral Heilmann and I will join you along with Dr. Takagishi and Mr. Wilson. We'll all sleep inside Rama tonight.
How many long-duration flares do you have?
Janos Tabori asked Irina Turgenev.
12, she answered. That should be plenty for today.
And tonight, when we go to sleep in there, it will be the darkest night that any of us have ever seen,
Dr. Takagishi said.
There will be no moon and no stars, no reflection off the ground, nothing but blackness all around.
What will the temperatures be? Wakefield asked.
We don't know for certain, the Japanese scientist answered. The initial drones carried only cameras, but the temperature in the region around the end of the tunnel was the same as in Rama 1. If that's any indication, then it should be about 10 degrees below freezing at the campsites.
Takagishi paused for a moment.
And getting warmer, he continued. We're now inside the orbit of Venus. We expect the lights to come on in another 8 or 9 days, and the cylindrical sea to melt from the bottom soon thereafter.
Hey, kidded Brown. Sounds as if you're becoming converted. You no longer qualify all your statements, just some of them.
With each datum that indicates this spaceship is like its predecessor 70 years ago, Takagishi replied, the probability that they are identical increases. Thus far, if we ignore the exact timing of the correction maneuver, everything about the 2 vehicles has been the same.
Nicole approached the group.
Well, look who's here, Janos said with his usual grin. Our 5th and final space cadet.
He noticed her swollen eyes.
And our new commander was right. You do look as if you might benefit from some rest.
I, for one, Richard Wakefield interjected, am disappointed that my rover assembly assistant will now be Yamanaka instead of Madame Dejada. At least our life science officer talks. I may have to recite Shakespeare to myself to stay awake.
He elbowed Yamanaka in the ribs. The Japanese pilot almost smiled.
I wanted to wish you all good luck, Nicole said. As I'm sure Dr. Brown has told you, I felt I was still too tired to be very helpful. I should be fresh and ready by the 2nd sortie.
Well,
Francesca Sabatini remarked impatiently, after her camera had panned around the room and captured 1 final close-up of each face.
Are we finally ready?
Let's go, said Wakefield. They headed toward the airlock at the front of the Newton spacecraft.
Chapter 22 Dawn Richard Wakefield worked quickly in the near darkness. He was halfway down the Alpha stairway, where the gravity, due to the centrifugal force created by the spin of Rama, had grown to 1/4 of a G. The light from his headgear illuminated the near field. He was almost finished with another pylon. He checked his air supply. It was already below the midpoint. By now they should have been deeper into Rama, closer to where they could breathe the ambient air. But they had underestimated how long it would take them to install the lightweight chairlifts. The concept was extremely simple, and they had practiced it several times in the simulations. The upper part of the job, when they had been in the vicinity of the ladders and virtually weightless, had been relatively straightforward. But at this level, the installation of each pylon was a different process, because of the increasing and changing gravity. Exactly 1,000 steps above Wakefield, Janos Taburi finished wrapping anchor lines around the metal banisters that lined the stairway. After almost 4 hours of tedious, repetitive work, he was becoming fatigued. He remembered the argument the engineering directors had advanced when he and Richard had recommended a specialized machine for the installation of the lifts.
"It's not cost-effective to create a robot for non-recurring uses," the man had said. "Robots are only good for recurring tasks."
Janos glanced below him, but could not see as far as the next pylon, 250 steps down the stairway.
"Is it time for lunch yet?" he said to Wakefield on his compact.
"Could be," was the response. "But we're way behind. We didn't send Yamanaka and Turgenev over to Gamma Stairway until 10:30. At the rate we're going, we'll be lucky to finish these lightweight lifts and the crude campsite today. We'll have to postpone the heavy load elevator and the rovers until tomorrow."
"Hiro and I are already eating," they both heard Turgenev say from the other side of the bowl. "We were hungry. We finished the chair rack and the upper motor in half an hour. We're down to pylon number 12.
"Good work," Wakefield said. "But I'll warn you that you're in the easy part. Around the ladders and the top of the stairway. Working weightless is a snap. Wait until the gravity is measurably different at each location."
"According to the laser rangefinder, cosmonaut Wakefield is exactly 8.13 kilometers away from me,"
everyone heard Dr. Takagishi interject.
"That doesn't tell me anything, Professor, unless I know where the hell you are."
"I'm standing on the ledge just outside our relay station, near the bottom of the Alpha stairway."
"Come on, Shig. Won't you Orientals ever go along with the rest of the world? The Newton is parked on the top of Rama, and you are at the top of the stairway. If we can't agree on up and down, how can we hope to communicate our innermost feelings? Much less play chess together."
"Thank you, Janos. I am at the top of the Alpha stairway. By the way, what are you doing? Your range is increasing rapidly."
"I'm sliding down the banister to meet Richard for lunch. I don't like eating fish and chips by myself."
"I'm also coming down for lunch," Francesca said. "I just finished filming an excellent demonstration of the Coriolis force, using Hiro and Irina. It will be great for elementary physics classes. I should be there in 5 minutes.
"Say, Signora," it was Wakefield again, "do you think we could talk you into some honest-to-goodness work? We stop what we're doing to accommodate your filming. Maybe we can make a trade with you."
"I'm willing," answered Francesca. "I'll help after lunch. But what I would like now is some light. Could you use one of your flares and let me capture you and Janos having a picnic on the Stairway of the Gods?"
Wakefield programmed a flare for a delayed ignition and climbed 80 steps to the nearest ledge. Cosmonaut Taburi arrived at the same spot half a minute before the light flooded them. From 2 kilometers above, Francesca panned across the 3 stairways and then zoomed in on the 2 figures sitting cross-legged on the ledge. From that perspective, Janos and Richard looked like 2 eagles nesting in a high mountain eyrie. By late afternoon, the Alpha chairlift was finished and ready for testing.
"We'll let you be the first customer," Richard Wakefield said to Francesca, "since you were good enough to help."
They were standing in full gravity at the foot of the incredible stairway. 30,000 steps stretched into the darkness of the artificial heavens above them. Beside them, on the central plane, the ultralight motor and the self-contained portable power station for the chairlift were already in operation. The cosmonauts had transported the electrical and mechanical subsystems in unassembled pieces on their backs, and assembly had required less than an hour. "The little chairs are not permanently connected to the cables," Wakefield explained to Francesca.
"At each end, there's a mechanism that attaches or detaches the chairs.
That way it's not necessary to have an almost infinite number of seats.
Francesca hesitantly sat down in the plastic structure that had been pulled away from a group of similar baskets hanging from a side cable.
"You're certain this is safe?" she said,
staring at the darkness above her.
"Of course," Richard said with a laugh. "It's exactly like the simulation. And I'll be in the next chair behind you, only 1 minute or 400 meters below. Altogether, the ride takes 40 minutes from bottom to top. Average speed is 24 kilometers per hour.
"And I don't do anything," Francesca remembered, "except sit tight, hold on, and activate my breathing system about 20 minutes from the summit."
"Don't forget to fasten your seatbelt," Wakefield reminded her with a smile. "If the cable were to slow down or stop near the top, where you are weightless, your momentum could cause you to sail out into the Raman void," he grinned. "But since the entire chairlift runs beside the stairway, in the event of any emergency, you could always climb out of your basket and walk back up to the hub along the stairs."
Richard nodded, and Janos Tiburi switched on the motor. Francesca was lifted off the ground and soon disappeared above them.
"I'll go right over to Gamma after I'm certain you're on your way," Richard said to Janos. "The second system should be easier. With all of us working together, we should be finished by 1900 at the latest."
"I'll have the campsite ready by the time you reach the summit," Janos remarked. "Do you think we're still going to stay down here tonight?"
"That doesn't make much sense," David Brown said from above.
He, or Takagishi, had monitored all cosmonaut communications throughout the day. "The rovers aren't ready yet. We had hoped to do some exploring tomorrow."
"If we each bring down a few subsystems," Wakefield replied, "Janos and I could assemble one rover tonight before we go to sleep. The second rover will probably be operational before noon tomorrow if we don't encounter any difficulties."
"That's a possible scenario," Dr. Brown responded. "Let's see how much progress we have made and how tired everyone is 3 hours from now." Richard climbed into his tiny chair and waited for the automatic loading algorithm in the processor to attach his seat to the cable.
"By the way," he said to his companion as he started his ascent, "thanks a lot for your good humor today. I might not have made it without the jokes."
Janos smiled and waved at his friend. Looking upward from his moving chair, Richard Wakefield could barely make out the light from Francesca's headgear. "She's more than 100 floors above me," he thought. "But only 2.5% of the distance from here to the hub. This place is immense." He reached in his pocket and pulled out the portable meteorological station that Takagishi had asked him to carry. The professor wanted a careful profile of all the atmospheric parameters in the north polar bowl of Rama. Of particular importance for his circulation models were the density and temperature of the air versus the distance below the airlock. Wakefield watched the pressure readings, which started at 1.05 bars, fall below Earth levels, and continue their steady, monotonic decline. The temperature held fixed at a cold -8 degrees Celsius. He leaned back and closed his eyes. It was a strange feeling, riding a basket upwards, ever upwards in the dark. Richard turned down the volume of one channel on his compact. The only ongoing conversation was between Yamanaka and Turgenev, and neither of them ever had very much to say. He increased the volume on Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, which was playing in the background on another channel. As he listened to the music, Richard was surprised at how his internal visions of brooks and flowers and green fields on Earth evoked a powerful feeling of homesickness. It was almost impossible for him to fathom the miraculous concatenation of events that had carried him from his boyhood home in Stratford to Cambridge, to the Space Academy in Colorado, and finally to here, to Rama, where he was riding a chairlift in the dark along the stairway to the gods. "No, Prospero," he said to himself, "no magician could ever have conceived of such a place." He remembered seeing The Tempest for the first time as a boy, and being frightened by the portrayal of a world whose mysteries might be beyond our comprehension. "There is no magic," he had said at the time. "There are only natural concepts that we cannot yet explain." Richard smiled. Prospero was not a mage. He was only a frustrated scientist. A moment later, Richard Wakefield was stupefied by the most amazing sight he had ever seen. As his chair was sailing soundlessly upward, parallel to the stairway, dawn burst upon Rama. 3 kilometers below him, cut into the central plain, the long straight valleys that ran from the edge of the bowl to the cylindrical sea suddenly exploded with light. The 6 linear suns of Rama, 3 in each hemicylinder, were carefully designed to produce a balanced illumination throughout the alien world. Wakefield's first feelings were of vertigo and nausea. He was suspended in air by a thin cable, thousands of meters above the ground. He closed his eyes and tried to maintain his bearings. "You will not fall," he said to himself.
"Aye!"
he heard Hiro Yamanaka yell. From the ensuing conversation, he could tell that Hiro, startled by the burst of light, had lost his footing near the middle of the gamma stairway. He had apparently fallen 20 or 30 meters before he had adroitly and luckily managed to grab part of the banister. "Are you all right?" David Brown asked.
"I think so,"
Yamanaka answered breathlessly. With the short crisis over, everyone started talking at once.
"This is fantastic,"
Dr. Takagishi was shouting.
"The light levels are phenomenal. And this is all happening before the thawing of the sea. It's different. It's altogether different."
"Have another module ready for me as soon as I reach the top," Francesca said. "I'm almost out of film."
"Such beauty. Such indescribable beauty," General O'Toole added. He and Nicole Desjardins were watching the monitor on board the Newton. The real-time picture from Francesca's camera was being transmitted to them through the relay station at the hub. Richard Wakefield said nothing. He simply stared, entranced by the world below him. He could barely discern Janos Taburi, the chairlift apparatus, and the half-completed campsite down at the bottom of the stairway. Nevertheless, the distance to them gave him some measure of this alien world. As he looked out across the hundreds of square kilometers of the central plain, he saw fascinating shapes in every direction. There were two features, however, that overwhelmed his imagination and vision. The cylindrical sea and the massive, pointed structures in the southern bowl opposite him, 50 kilometers away. As his eyes grew more accustomed to the light, the gigantic central spire in the southern bowl seemed to grow larger and larger. It had been called Big Horn by the first explorers. "Can it really be 8 kilometers tall?" Wakefield asked himself. The 6 smaller spires, surrounding the Big Horn in a hexagonal pattern and connected both to it and the walls of Rama by enormous flying buttresses, were each larger than anything made by man on Earth. Yet they were dwarfed by this neighboring prominence, originating from the very center of the bowl and growing straight along the spin axis of the cylinder. In the foreground, halfway between Wakefield's position near the North Pole and that mammoth construction in the south, a band of bluish-white ringed the cylindrical world. The frozen sea seemed illogical and out of place. It could never melt, the mind wanted to say, or all the water would fall toward the central axis. But the cylindrical sea was held in its banks by the centrifugal force of Rama. None knew better than the Newton crew that on its shore a human being would have the same weight as he would standing beside a terrestrial ocean. The island city in the middle of the cylindrical sea was Rama's New York. To Richard, its skyscrapers had not been too imposing in the views that had been offered by the light from the flares. But, under the light of the Raman suns, it was clear that this city held center stage. The eyes were drawn to New York from any point inside Rama. The dense oval island of buildings was the only break in the orderly annulus that formed the cylindrical sea.
"Just look at New York!"
Dr. Takagishi was gushing excitedly into his compact.
"There must be almost 1,000 buildings over 200 meters tall."
He paused only a second.
"That's where they live. I know it. New York must be our target."
After the initial outburst, there was a protracted silence, while each of the cosmonauts privately integrated the sunlit world of Rama into his own consciousness. Richard could now clearly see Francesca, 400 meters above him, as his chair crossed the transition between the stairways and the ladders and closed in on the hub. "Admiral Heilman and I have just had a quick conversation," David Brown said, breaking the silence. "With some advice from Dr. Takagishi, there seems to be no obvious reason to change our plans for this sortie, at least not the early part. Unless something else unexpected occurs, we will go forward with Wakefield's suggestion. We will finish the 2 chairlifts, carry the rover down for assembly later this evening, and all sleep in the campsite at the foot of the stairway as planned."
"Don't forget me," Janos hollered into his compact. "I'm the only one who doesn't have much of a view."
Richard Wakefield unfastened his seatbelt and stepped out onto the ledge. He looked down to where the stairway disappeared from view.
"Roger, Cosmonaut Taburi. We have arrived back at Station Alpha. Whenever you give the signal, we will hoist you up to join us."
Chapter 23. Nightfall. Considering the regular abuse that he received from his neurotic father, and the emotional scars that must remain from his youthful marriage to British actress Sarah Tidings, cosmonaut Wakefield is remarkably well-adjusted. He underwent 2 years of professional therapy after his celebrated divorce, concluding a year before he entered the Space Academy in 2192. His scholastic record at the Academy is still unequaled to this day. His professors in electrical engineering and computer sciences all insist that by the time of his graduation, Wakefield knew more than any member of the faculty. Except for a wariness where intimacy is concerned, particularly with women, he has apparently had no sustained emotional involvement since the breakup of his marriage, Wakefield exhibits none of the antisocial behavior usually found in abused children. Although his SC was low as a youth, he has grown less arrogant as he has matured, and is now less likely to force his brilliance upon others. His honesty and character are unassailable. Knowledge, not power or money, seems to be his goal. Nicole finished reading the psychological assessment for Richard Wakefield and rubbed her eyes. It was very late. She had been studying the dossiers ever since the crew inside Rama had settled down to sleep. They would be awakening for their second day in that strange world in less than 2 hours. Her 6-hour shift as communications officer would start in another 30 minutes. So, out of this entire bunch, Nicole was thinking, there are only 3 that are beyond question. Those 4 with their illegal media contract have already compromised themselves. Yamanaka and Turgenev are unknowns. Wilson is marginally stable and has had his own agenda anyway. That leaves O'Toole, Takagishi, and Wakefield. Nicole washed her face and hands and sat down again at the terminal. She exited from the Wakefield dossier and returned to the main menu of the data cube. She scanned the comparative statistics available and keyed a pair of displays to appear side by side on the screen. On the left-hand side was the ordered set of IE scores for each member of the crew. Opposite, for comparison, Nicole had displayed the SC indices for the Newton dozen. The IE scores were Wakefield, plus 5.58, Sabatini, plus 4.22, Brown, plus 4.17, Takagishi, plus 4.02, Taburi, plus 3.37, Bortsov, plus 3.28, Desjardins, plus 3.04, O'Toole, plus 2.92, Turgenev, plus 2.87, Yamanaka, plus 2.66, Wilson, plus 2.48, Heilman, plus 2.24. The SC indices were O'Toole, 86, Bortsov, 84, Takagishi, 82, Wilson, 78, Desjardins, 71, Heilman, 68, Taburi, 64, Yamanaka, 62, Turgenev, 60, Wakefield, 58, Sabatini, 56, and Brown, 49. Although Nicole had very quickly glanced through most of the information in the dossiers earlier, she had not read all the charts and all the crew members. Some of the indices she now saw for the first time. She was particularly surprised by the very high intelligence rating for Francesca Sabatini. What a waste, Nicole thought immediately. All that potential being used for such ordinary pursuits. The overall intelligence level of the crew was quite impressive. Every cosmonaut was in the top 1% of the population. Nicole was 1 in 1,000, and she was only in the middle of the dozen. Wakefield's intelligence rating was truly exceptional and placed him in the super genius category. Nicole had never before personally known someone with such high scores on the standardized tests. Although her training in psychiatry had taught her to distrust attempts to quantify personality traits, Nicole was intrigued by the SC indices as well. She herself would have intuitively placed O'Toole, Bortsov, and Takagishi at the top of the list. All 3 men seemed confident, balanced, and sensitive to others. But she was astonished by Wilson's high socialization coefficient. He must have been an altogether different person before he became involved with Francesca. Nicole wondered for a brief moment why her own SC index was no higher than a 71. Then she remembered that as a young woman she had been more withdrawn and self-centered. So what about Wakefield, she asked herself, realizing that he was the only viable candidate to help her understand what had happened inside the Rosur software during Bortsov's operation.
Could she trust him? And could she enlist Richard's help without revealing some of her far-fetched suspicions? Again, the thought of abandoning her investigation altogether seemed very appealing. "Nicole," she said to herself, "if this conspiracy idea of yours turns out to be a waste of time." But Nicole was convinced that there were enough unanswered questions to warrant continuing her investigation. She resolved to talk to Wakefield. After determining that she could add her own files to the King's data cube, she created a new file, a 19th file, simply called Nicole. She called in her word processing subroutine and wrote a brief memorandum. 3300. Have determined for certain that Rosur malfunctioned during Bortsov procedure due to external manual command after initial load and verification, enlisting Wakefield for support. Nicole pulled a blank data cube from the supply drawer adjacent to her computer. She copied onto it both her memorandum and all the information stored on the cube that she had been given by King Henry. When she dressed for her work shift in her flight suit, she put the duplicate cube in her pocket. General O'Toole was dozing in the command and control complex of the military spacecraft when Nicole arrived to give him a break. Although the visual displays in this smaller vehicle were not quite as breathtaking as those in the scientific ship, the layout of the military CCC as a communications center was far superior, especially from a human engineering point of view. All the controls could easily be handled by a single cosmonaut. O'Toole apologized for not being awake. He pointed to the three monitors that showed three different views of the same scene, the rest of the crew fast asleep inside the crude campsite at the foot of Alpha Stairway. "This last 5 hours has not been what you would call exciting," he said. Nicole smiled. "General, you don't need to apologize to me. I know you've been on duty for almost 24 hours. General O'Toole stood up. "After you left," he summarized, checking his electronic log on one of the six monitors in front of him, "they finished dinner, and then they started the assembly of the first rover. The automatic navigation program failed its self-test, but Wakefield found a problem, a software bug in one of the subroutines that was changed in the last delivery, and fixed it. Tabori took the rover for a test drive before the crew prepared for sleep. At the end of the day, Francesca did a stirring short piece for transmission to the Earth." He paused for a moment. "Would you like to see it?" Nicole nodded. O'Toole activated the far-right television monitor, and Francesca appeared in a close-up outside the enclosed campsite. The frame showed a portion of the bottom of the stairway, and the equipment for the chairlift as well.
"It is time to sleep in Rama," she intoned.
She looked up and around her.
"The lights in this amazing world came on unexpectedly about 9 hours ago, showing us in more detail the elaborate handiwork of our intelligent cousins from across the stars."
A montage of still photographs and short videos, some taken by the drones and some taken by Francesca herself on that day, punctuated her tour of the artificial worldlet that the crew was about to explore. At the end of the brief segment, the camera was again fixed on Francesca.
"Nobody knows why this second spacecraft, in less than a century, has invaded our little domain at the edge of the galaxy. Perhaps this magnificent creation has no explanation that would be even remotely comprehensible to us human beings. But perhaps somewhere in this vast and precise world of metal, we will find some keys that will unlock the mysteries enshrouding the creatures who constructed this vehicle."
She smiled, and her nostrils flared dramatically.
"And if we do, then perhaps we will have moved one step closer to an understanding of ourselves, and maybe our gods as well."
Nicole could tell that General O'Toole was moved by Francesca's oratory. Despite her personal antipathy for the woman, Nicole begrudgingly acknowledged again that Francesca was talented.
"She captures my feelings about this venture so well," O'Toole said enthusiastically. "I just wish I could be that articulate."
Nicole sat down at the console and entered the handover code. She followed the listed procedure on the monitor and checked out all the equipment.
"All right, General," she said as she turned around in her chair. "I believe I can handle it from here."
O'Toole lingered behind her. It was obvious that he wanted to talk.
"I had a long discussion with Signora Sabatini 3 nights ago, he said, "about religion. She told me that she had become an agnostic before finally coming back to the church. She told me that thinking about Rama had made her a Catholic again."
There was a long silence. For some reason, the 15th century church in the old village of Saint-Étienne de Chigny, 800 meters down the road from Beauvoir, came into Nicole's mind. She remembered standing inside the church with her father on a beautiful spring day and being fascinated by the light scattering through the stained glass windows.
"Did God make the colors?"
Nicole had asked her father.
"Some say so,"
he had answered laconically.
"And what do you think, Papa?"
she had then asked.
"I must admit," General O'Toole was saying as Nicole forced herself to return to the present, "that this entire voyage has been spiritually uplifting for me. I feel closer to God now than I have ever felt before. There's something about contemplating the vastness of the universe that humbles you and makes you—"
He stopped himself.
"I'm sorry." He started to apologize. "I have imposed."
"No,"
Nicole answered.
"No, you haven't. I find your religious certitude very refreshing."
"Nevertheless, I hope I haven't offended you in any way. Religion is a very private matter."
He smiled.
"But sometimes it's hard not to share your feelings, particularly since both you and Signora Sabatini are Catholics as well."
As O'Toole left the control complex, Nicole wished him a sound sleep during his nap. When he had gone, she removed the duplicate data cube from her pocket and placed it in the CCC cube reader. "At least this way," she said to herself, "I have backed up my information sources." Into her mind came a picture of Francesca Sabatini, listening intently, while General O'Toole waxed philosophical about the religious significance of Rama. "You're an amazing woman," Nicole thought. "You do whatever it takes. Even immorality and hypocrisy are acceptable." Dr. Shigeru Takagishi stared in rapt silence at the towers and spheres of New York, 4 kilometers away. From time to time, he would walk over to the telescope that he had temporarily set up on the cliff overlooking the cylindrical sea and study a particular feature in that alien landscape.
"You know," he said at length to cosmonauts Wakefield and Sabatini, "I don't believe the reports the first crew gave on New York are entirely accurate. Or else this is a different spaceship."
Neither Richard nor Francesca responded. Wakefield was engrossed in the last stages of assembly of the icemobile, and Francesca, as usual, was busy video-recording Wakefield's efforts.
"It looks as if there are certainly 3 identical parts to the city,"
Dr. Takagishi continued, primarily to himself,
"and 3 subdivisions within each of those parts. But all 9 sections are not absolutely the same. There appear to be subtle differences."
"There," said Richard Wakefield, standing up with a satisfied smile. "That ought to do it. A full day ahead of schedule. I'll just quickly test all the important engineering functions."
Francesca glanced at her watch.
"We're almost 30 minutes behind the revised timeline. Are we still going to take a fast look at New York before dinner?"
Wakefield shrugged his shoulders and looked at Takagishi. Francesca walked over to the Japanese scientist.
"What do you say, Shigeru? Shall we take a quick run across the ice and give the people on Earth a close-up view of the Rama version of New York?"
"By all means,"
Takagishi answered.
"I can't wait."
"Only if you will be back at camp by 19:30 at the latest," David Brown interrupted. He was in the helicopter with Admiral Heilman and Reggie Wilson. "We need to do some serious planning tonight. We may want to revise the deployments for tomorrow."
"Roger," said Wakefield. "If we forget about the pulley system for now and have no problem carrying the icemobile down the stairs, we should be able to cross the sea in 10 minutes each way. That would get us back to the camp in plenty of time."
"We've overflown many of the features of the Northern Hemisphere this afternoon," Brown said. "No biots anywhere. The cities look like duplicates of each other. There were no surprises anywhere in the Central Plain. I personally think that maybe we should attack the mysterious South tomorrow."
"New York!"
Takagishi shouted.
"A detailed reconnaissance of New York should be our goal for tomorrow."
Brown didn't answer. Takagishi walked out to the edge of the cliff and stared down at the ice 50 meters below. To his left, the unimposing narrow stairway cut in the cliff descended in short steps.
"How heavy is the icemobile?"
Takagishi asked.
"Not very," Wakefield answered, "but it's bulky. Are you certain you don't want to wait for me to install the pulleys? We can always go across tomorrow."
"I can help carry it," Francesca interjected. "If we don't at least see New York, we will not be able to make educated inputs at the planning meeting tonight."
"All right," Richard replied, shaking his head in amusement at Francesca. "Anything for journalism. I'll go first, so that most of the lifting is on my back. Francesca, get in the middle.
Dr. Takagishi at the top. Watch out for the runners. They are sharp on the edges.
The climb down to the surface of the cylindrical sea was uneventful.
Goodness, Francesca Sabatini said as they prepared to cross the ice. That was easy. Why is a pulley system needed at all?
Because sometimes we may be carrying something else, or, perish the thought, we may need to defend ourselves during ascent or descent.
Wakefield and Takagishi sat in the front of the icemobile. Francesca was in the back with her video camera. Takagishi became more and more animated as they drew closer to New York.
Just look at that place, he said,
when the icemobile was about 500 meters from the opposite shore.
Can there be any doubt that this is the capital of Rama?
As the trio approached the shore, the breathtaking sight of the strange city silenced all conversation. Everything about New York's complicated structure spoke of order and purposeful creation by intelligent beings. Yet, the first set of cosmonauts, 70 years earlier, had found it as empty of life as the rest of Rama. Was this vast complex, broken into 9 sections, indeed an enormously complicated machine, as the first visitors had suggested? Or was the long, thin island, 10 kilometers by 3, actually a city, whose denizens had long ago disappeared? They parked the icemobile on the edge of the frozen sea and walked along a path until they found a stairway leading to the ramparts of the wall surrounding the city. The excited Takagishi loped along about 20 meters in front of Wakefield and Sabatini. As they ascended, more and more of the details of the city became apparent. Richard was immediately intrigued by the geometrical shapes of the buildings. In addition to the normal, tall, thin skyscrapers, there were scattered spheres, rectangular solids, even an occasional polyhedron. And they were definitely arranged in some kind of a pattern. Yes, he thought to himself, as his eyes scanned the fascinating complex of structures, over there is a dodecahedron, there a pentahedron. His mathematical ruminations were interrupted when all the lights were suddenly extinguished, and the entire interior of Rama was plunged into darkness.
Chapter 24 Sounds in the Darkness. At first, Takagishi could see absolutely nothing. It was as if he had suddenly been struck blind. He blinked twice and stood motionless in the total darkness. The momentary silence on the comlinks erupted into hopeless noise as all the cosmonauts began to talk at the same time. Calmly, fighting against his growing fear, Takagishi tried to remember the scene that had been in front of his eyes at the moment the lights were extinguished. He had been standing on the wall overlooking New York, about a meter from the dangerous edge. In the final second, he had been looking off to the left and had just glimpsed a staircase descending into the city about 200 meters away. Then the scene had vanished.
Takagishi, he heard Wakefield calling. Are you all right?
He turned around to acknowledge the question and noticed that his knees had become weak. In the complete darkness he had lost his orientation. How many degrees had he turned? Had he been facing the city directly? Again, he recalled the last image. The elevated wall was 20 or 30 meters above the floor of the city. A fall would be fatal.
I'm here, he said, tentatively. But I'm too close to the edge.
He dropped down on all fours. The metal was cold against his hands.
We're coming, Francesca said. I'm trying to find a light on my video camera.
Takagishi turned down the volume on his compact and listened for the sound of his companions. A few seconds later, he saw a light in the distance. He could barely make out the forms of his two associates.
Where are you, Shigeru?
Francesca asked. The light from her camera illuminated only the area immediately around her.
Up here! Up here!
He waved before he realized that they could not see him.
I want complete quiet, David Brown shouted over the communication system, until everyone is accounted for.
The conversation ceased after a few seconds.
Now, he continued, Francesca, what's going on down there?
We're climbing the stairway up the wall, on the New York side, David, about 100 meters from where we parked the icemobile. Dr. Takagishi was ahead of us, already at the top. We have the light from my camera. We're going to meet him.
Yanas, Dr. Brown said next. Where are you in rover number 2?
About 3 kilometers from camp. The headlights are working fine. We could return in 10 minutes or so.
Go back there and man the navigation console. We'll stay airborne until you verify that the homing system is operational from your side. Francesca,
Be careful, but come back to camp as fast as you can, and give us a report every 2 minutes or so.
Roger, David, she said.
Francesca switched off her compact and called for Takagishi again. Despite the fact that he was only 30 meters away, it took Francesca and Richard over a minute to find him in the dark. Takagishi was relieved to touch his colleagues. They sat down beside him on the wall and listened to the renewed chatter on the compact. O'Toole and Desjardins verified that there had been no other observed changes inside Rama at the time the lights had gone out. The half-dozen portable scientific stations that had already been deployed in the alien spaceship had exhibited no meaningful perturbations. Temperatures, wind velocities and directions, and near-field spectroscopic measurements were all unchanged. "So the lights went out," Wakefield said. "I admit that it was scary, but it was no big deal." "Probably..." "Shh," said Takagishi abruptly. He reached down and turned off both his and Wakefield's compact.
"Do you hear that noise?"
To Wakefield, the sudden silence was nearly as unnerving as the total darkness had been a few minutes before.
"No,"
he said in a whisper, after listening for several seconds.
"But my ears are not very..."
"Shh!"
Now it's Francesca's turn.
"Are you talking about that distant, high-pitched scraping sound?"
she whispered.
"Yes,"
said Takagishi, quietly but excitedly.
"Like something is brushing against a metallic surface. It suggests movement."
Wakefield listened again. Maybe he could hear something. Maybe he was imagining it.
"Come on,"
he said to the others out loud.
"Let's go back to the icemobile." "Wait,"
said Takagishi, as Richard stood up.
"It seemed to stop just as you spoke."
He leaned over to Francesca.
"Turn off the light,"
he said softly.
"Let's sit here in the darkness and see if we can hear it again."
Wakefield sat back down beside his companions. With the camera light off, it was absolutely black around them. The only sound was their breathing. They waited a full minute. They heard nothing. Just as Wakefield was about to insist that they leave, he heard a sound from the direction of New York. It was like hard brushes dragging across metal, but there was also an embedded high-frequency noise, as if a tiny voice were singing very fast, that punctuated the nearly constant scraping. The sound was definitely louder and eerie. Wakefield felt his spine tingle.
"Do you have a tape recorder?"
Takagishi whispered to Francesca. The scraping stopped at the sound of Takagishi's voice. The trio waited another 15 seconds. "Hey there! Hey there!" They heard David Brown's loud voice on the emergency interrupt channel. "Is everybody all right? You're way overdue for a report."
"Yes, David," Francesca replied. "We're still here. We heard an unusual sound coming from New York."
"Now's not the time for dilly-dallying. We have a major crisis on our hands. All our new plans have assumed that Rama would be constantly lit. We need to regroup."
"All right," Wakefield responded. "We're leaving the wall now. If all goes well, we shall be back to the campsite in less than an hour."
Dr. Shigeru Takagishi was reluctant to leave New York with the mystery of the strange sound unresolved. But he understood completely that now was not the appropriate time for a scientific foray into the city. As the icemobile raced across the frozen cylindrical sea, the Japanese scientist smiled to himself. He was happy. He knew that he had heard a new sound, something decidedly different from any of the sounds catalogued by the first Rama team. This was a good beginning. Cosmonauts Taburi and Wakefield were the last two to ride up the chairlift beside the Alpha Stairway.
"Takagishi was really quite irritated with Dr. Brown, wasn't he?"
Richard was saying to Janos, as he helped the little Hungarian disembark from the chair. They glided along the ramp towards the ferry.
"I've never seen him so angry," Janos replied. "Shig is a consummate professional, and he has great pride in his knowledge of Rama. For Brown to discount the noise you guys heard in such an offhand manner suggests an absence of respect for Takagishi. I don't blame Shig for being irritated."
They climbed on board the ferry and activated the transportation module. The vast darkness of Rama retreated behind them as they eased through the lighted corridor toward the Newton.
"It was a very strange sound," Richard said. "It really gave me the chills." "I have no idea if it was a new sound, or if maybe Norton and his team heard the same thing 70 years ago. But I do know that I had a bad case of the willies when I was standing there on the wall.
Even Francesca was pissed off at Brown at first. She wanted to do a feature interview with Shig for her nightly report. Brown talked her out of it, but I'm not certain he completely convinced her that strange noises are not news.
Luckily, she had enough of her story with just the lights going out. The two men descended from the ferry and approached the airlock.
Phew, said Janos. I'm bushed. It has been a couple of long and hectic days.
Yeah, Richard agreed. We thought we would be spending the next two nights at the campsite. Instead, we're back up here. I wonder what surprises are in store for us tomorrow.
Janos smiled at his friend.
You know what's funny about all this? He said.
He did not wait for Wakefield to answer.
Bron really believes he's in charge of this mission. Did you see how he reacted when Takagishi suggested that we could explore New York in the dark? Bron probably thinks it was his decision for us to return to the Newton and abort the first sortie.
Richard looked at Janos with a quizzical smile.
It wasn't, of course.
Janos continued.
Rama made the decision for us to leave, and Rama will decide what we do next.
Chapter 25 A Friend in Need. In his dream, he was lying on a futon in a 17th-century ryokan. The room was very large, 9 tatami mats in all. To his left, in the yard on the other side of the open screen, was a perfect miniaturized garden with tiny trees and a manicured stream. He was waiting for a young woman.
Takagishi-san? Are you awake?
He stirred and reached out for the communicator.
Hello?
He said, his voice betraying his grogginess.
Who is it?
Nicole Desjardins, the voice said. I'm sorry to call you so early, but I need to see you. It's urgent.
Give me 3 minutes,
Takagishi said. There was a knock on his door exactly 3 minutes later. Nicole greeted him and entered the room. She was carrying a data cube.
Do you mind?
She said, pointing to the computer console. Takagishi shook his head.
Yesterday, there were half a dozen separate incidents, Nicole said gravely,
pointing at some blips on the monitor,
including the two largest aberrations I have ever seen in your heart data.
She looked at him.
Are you certain that you and your doctor provided me with complete historical records?
Takagishi nodded.
Then I have reason for concern, she continued.
The irregularities yesterday suggest that your chronic diastolic abnormality has worsened.
Perhaps the valve has sprung a new leak. Perhaps the long periods of weightlessness.
Or perhaps,
Takagishi interrupted with a soft smile,
I became overly excited, and my extra adrenaline aggravated the problem.
Nicole stared at the Japanese scientist.
That's possible, Dr. Takagishi. One of the major incidents occurred just after the lights went out. I guess it was when you were listening to your strange sound.
And the other? By chance, could it have been during my argument with Dr. Brown in the campsite? If so, that would support my hypothesis.
Cosmonaut Desjardins touched several keys on the console, and her software entered a new subroutine. She studied the data displayed on two sides of a split screen.
Yes, she said. It looks right. The second incident took place 20 minutes before we started leaving Rama. That would have been toward the end of the meeting.
She moved away from the monitor. But I can't dismiss the bizarre behavior of your heart just because you are excited. They stared at each other for several long seconds.
What are you trying to tell me, Doctor?
Takagishi said softly.
Are you going to confine me to my quarters on the Newton? Now? At the most significant moment in my professional career?
I'm considering it, Nicole answered directly. Your health is more important to me than your career. I've already lost one member of the crew. I'm not certain that I could forgive myself if I lost another.
She saw the entreaty in her colleague's face.
I know how critical these sorties into Rama are to you. I'm trying to find some kind of rationalization that will allow me to overlook yesterday's data.
Nicole sat down at the far end of the bed and looked away.
But as a doctor, not a Newton cosmonaut, it's very, very tough.
She heard Takagishi approach and felt his hand gently on her shoulder.
I know how difficult it has been for you these last few days, he said. But it was not your fault. All of us are aware that General Bortsov's death was unavoidable.
Nicole recognized the respect and friendship in Takagishi's face. She thanked him with her eyes.
I very much appreciate what you did for me before launch, he continued. If you feel compelled to limit my activities now, I will not object.
Damn it, said Nicole, standing up quickly. It's not that simple. I've been studying your overnight data for almost an hour. Look at this. Your chart for the last 10 hours is perfectly normal.
There's not a trace of any anomaly. And you had had no incidents for weeks until yesterday. What is with you, Shig? Do you have a bad heart? Or just a weird one?
Takagishi smiled.
My wife told me once that I had a strange heart. But I think she was referring to something altogether different.
Nicole activated her scanner and displayed the data on the monitor in real time.
There we are again, she shook her head. The signature of a perfectly healthy heart. No cardiologist in the world would argue with my conclusion.
She moved towards the door.
So, what's the verdict, Doc?
Takagishi asked. I haven't decided, she answered. You could help.
Have another one of your incidents in the next few hours and make it easy for me.
She waved goodbye.
See you at breakfast.
Richard Wakefield was coming out of his room as Nicole headed down the hall after leaving Takagishi. She made a spontaneous decision to talk to him about the Rose Sewer software.
Good morning, Princess, he said as he approached. What are you doing awake at this hour? Something exciting, I hope.
As a matter of fact, Nicole replied in the same playful tone, I was coming to talk to you.
He stopped to listen.
Do you have a minute?
For you, Madam Doctor,
he answered with an exaggerated smile. I have 2 minutes, but no more.
Mind you, I'm hungry. And if I'm not fed quickly when I'm hungry, I turn into an awful ogre.
Nicole laughed.
What's on your mind?
He added lightly.
Could we go into your room? She asked.
I knew it,
he said, spinning around and sliding quickly toward his door.
It's finally happened. Just like in my dreams, an intelligent, beautiful woman is going to declare her undying affection.
Nicole could not suppress a chortle.
Wakefield, she interrupted, still grinning. You are hopeless. Are you never serious?
I have some business to discuss with you.
Oh, darn, Richard said dramatically. Business. In that case, I'm going to limit you to the 2 minutes I allocated you earlier. Business also makes me hungry and grumpy.
Richard Wakefield opened the door to his room and waited for Nicole to enter. He offered her the chair in front of his computer monitor and sat down behind her on the bed. She turned around to face him. On the shelf above his bed were a dozen tiny figurines, similar to the ones she had seen in Tabori's room and at the Bortsov banquet.
"Allow me to introduce you to some of my menagerie,"
Richard said, noticing her curiosity.
"You've met Lord and Lady Macbeth, Puck, and Bottom. This matched pair is Tybalt and Mercutio from Romeo and Juliet. Next to them are Iago and Othello, followed by Prince Hal, Falstaff, and the wonderful Mistress Quickly. The last one on the right is my closest friend, the Bard, or TB for short."
As Nicole watched, Richard activated a switch near the head of his bed, and TB climbed down a ladder from the shelf to the bed. The 20-centimeter-high robot carefully navigated the folds in the bed coverings and came over to greet Nicole.
"And what be your name, fair lady?"
TB said.
"I am Nicole Desjardins," she replied. "Sounds French,"
the robot said immediately.
"But you don't look French. At least not Valois."
The robot appeared to be staring at her.
"You look more like a child of Othello and Desdemona."
Nicole was astonished.
"How did you do that?"
she asked.
"I'll explain later,"
Richard said with a wave of his hand.
"Do you have a favourite Shakespearean sonnet?"
he now inquired.
"If you do, recite a line, or give TB a number."
"Full many a glorious morning," recalled Nicole. "Have I seen,"
the robot added,
"flatter the mountain tops with sovereign eye, kissing with golden face the meadows green, gilding pale streams with heavenly alchemy."
The little robot recited the sonnet with fluid head and arm movements, as well as a wide range of facial expressions. Again, Nicole was impressed by Richard Wakefield's creativity. She remembered the key four lines of the sonnet from her university days and mumbled them along with TB.
"Even so my sun one early morn did shine, with all triumphant splendour on my brow. But, out, alack, he was but 1 hour mine. The region cloud hath masked him from me now."
After the robot finished the final couplet, Nicole, who was moved by the almost forgotten words, found herself applauding.
"And he can do all the sonnets?" she asked.
Richard nodded.
"Plus many, many of the more poetic, dramatic speeches. But that's not his most outstanding capability.
Remembering passages from Shakespeare only requires plenty of storage. TB is also a very intelligent robot. He can carry on a conversation better than...
Richard stopped himself in mid-sentence.
I'm sorry, Nicole. I'm monopolizing the time. You said you had some business to discuss?
But you've already used my 2 minutes, she said with a twinkle in her eye. Are you certain that you won't die of starvation if I take 5 more minutes of your time?
Nicole quickly summarized her investigation into the Rosur software malfunction, including her conclusion that the fault protection algorithms must have been disabled by manual commands. She indicated that she could go no further with her own analysis, and that she would like some help from Richard. She did not discuss her suspicions.
Should be a snap, he said with a smile.
All I have to do is find the place in memory where the commands are buffered and stored. That could take a little time, given the size of the storage, but these memories are generally designed with logical architectures. However, I don't understand why you're doing all this detective work. Why don't you simply ask Janos and the others if they input any commands?
That's the problem, Nicole replied. Nobody recalls commanding Rosur at any time after the final load and verify. When Janos hit his head during the maneuver, I thought his fingers were on the control box. He doesn't remember, and I can't be certain.
Richard's brow furrowed. It would be very unlikely that Janos just happened to toggle the fault protection enable switch with a random command. That would mean the overall design was stupid.
He thought for a moment.
Oh well, he continued. There's no need to speculate. Now you've aroused my curiosity. I'll look at the problem as soon as I have...
Break, 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 break. They both heard Otto Hallmann's voice on the communicator.
Will everyone come immediately to the Science Control Center for a meeting? We have a new development. The lights inside Rama just came on again.
Richard opened the door and followed Nicole into the corridor.
Thanks for your help, Nicole said. I appreciate it very much.
Tag me after I do something, Richard said with a grin. I'm notorious for promises. Now, what do you think is the meaning of all these games with the lights?
Chapter 26 Second Sortie.
David Brown had placed a single large sheet of paper on the table in the middle of the control center. Francesca had divided it into partitions, representing hours, and was now busy writing down whatever he told her. The damn mission planning software is too inflexible to be used in a situation like this, Dr. Brown was saying to Janos Taburi and Richard Wakefield. It's only good when the sequence of activities being planned is consistent with one of the pre-flight strategies.
Janos walked over to one of the monitors.
Maybe you can use it better than I can, Dr. Brown continued, but I have found it much easier this morning to rely on pencil and paper.
Janos called up a software program for mission sequencing and began to key in some data.
Wait a minute, Richard Wakefield interjected.
Janos stopped typing on the keyboard and turned to listen to his colleague.
We're getting all worked up over nothing. We don't need to plan the entire next sortie at this moment. In any case, we know the first major activity segment must be the completion of the infrastructure. That will take another 10 or 12 hours. The rest of the sortie design can be done in parallel.
Richard's right, Francesca added. We're trying to do everything too fast. Let's send the space cadets into Rama to finish setting up. While they're gone, we can work out the details of the sortie.
That's impractical, Dr. Brown replied. The Academy graduates are the only ones who know how long each of the various engineering activities should take. We can't make meaningful timelines without them.
Then one of us will stay here with you, Janos Taburi said.
He grinned.
And we can use Heilman or O'Toole inside as an extra worker. That shouldn't slow us down too much.
A consensus decision was reached in half an hour. Nicole would stay on board the Newton again, at least until the infrastructure was completed, and represent the cadets in the mission planning process. Admiral Heilman would go into Rama with the 4 other professional cosmonauts. They would finish the remaining 3 infrastructure tasks, the assembly of the rest of the vehicles, the deployment of another 12 portable monitoring stations in the northern hemicylinder, and the construction of the Beta campsite communications complex on the north side of the cylindrical sea. Richard Wakefield was in the process of reviewing all the detailed subtasks with his small team when Reggie Wilson, who had been virtually silent during the entire morning, suddenly jumped up from his chair.
"This is all bullshit," he shouted. "I can't believe all the nonsense I'm hearing."
Richard stopped his review. Brown and Takagishi, who had already started discussing the sortie design, were suddenly silent. All eyes were focused on Reggie Wilson.
"A man died here 4 days ago," he said. "Killed, most likely, by whoever or whatever is operating that gigantic spacecraft.
but we went inside exploring anyway. Next, the lights go on and off unexpectedly.
Wilson looked around the room at the rest of the crew. His eyes were wild. His forehead was sweating.
And what do we all do, huh? How do we respond to this warning from alien creatures far superior to us? We sit down calmly and plan the rest of our exploration of their vehicle. Don't any of you get it? They don't want us in there. They want us to leave, to go home to Earth.
Wilson's outburst was greeted by an uncomfortable silence. At length, General O'Toole walked over beside Reggie Wilson. Reggie, he said quietly, we were all upset by General Bortsoff's death, but none of the rest of us see any connection.
Then you're blind, man. You're blind. I was up in that goddamn helicopter when the lights went out. One minute it was bright as a summer's day, and the next, poof, it was pitch black. It was fucking weird, man. Somebody turned out all the lights. In this discussion, never once have I heard anybody ask why the lights went out. What's the matter with you people? Are you too smart to be afraid?
Wilson ranted for several minutes. His recurring theme was always the same. The Ramans had planned Bortsoff's death. They were sending a warning with the lights going on and off. There would be more disasters if the crew insisted on continuing with the exploration. General O'Toole stood beside Reggie during the entire episode. Dr. Brown, Francesca, and Nicole had a hurried discussion on the side, and then Nicole approached Wilson.
Reggie,
she said informally, interrupting his diatribe,
why don't you and General O'Toole come with me? We can continue this conversation.